welcome to another edition of Turn Out a Punk. I'm your host, Damien Abraham. Once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved in punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, a friend of mine, one of the best front people in the world, Jenny Beth, is on the show, and we will have more on that in 1 second. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham. Thank you, Tristan. I love you so much, buddy. And also, thank you for everything you do on the show. I don't love you because you do this stuff. I love you, you know. Yeah, I love you because I love you. But then, you know, anyway, I could be having this call on the phone. So anyway, I'll move on. And if you wanted to get in touch with the podcast over Facebook, there's a Facebook page. There's an Instagram page. Both of those are at Turn Out a Punk. You can find me on various forms of social media, like Twitter and Instagram, basically, at Left4Damien. If you want to support the show, the best way to support the show is by telling everyone you know that you love what we do here. Letting people know that you find this podcast entertaining, that's the best way to support. But there's also ways to support the show by subscribing to it and rating it on iTunes, giving it a 5-star review. Thank you to everyone who does it, and thank you to people who give it less, too. But I'm really thanking the 5-star review people. Also, you can head over to patreon.com. There's a Turned Out a Punk Patreon page that we put footnotes up over there and other stuff. And thank you. Thank you so much to the people that support the Patreon. Really, I can't thank you people enough for believing in this show, you know, and keeping this thing going the way you have. Also, I got to give a huge thank you to the fine folks at Vans. Vans Shoes came aboard a long time ago. House of Vans came aboard a long time ago on this podcast because they believed in what we're doing here and they wanted me to do it without having to spend money out of my own pocket to keep this thing going each and every week. And I really got to thank them for continuing to support this podcast because it is it's something I really love doing. I love doing this thing. I love doing this thing because it gives me a chance to learn and to nerd out and, you know, and yeah, have great conversations like today on the show with my buddy, Jenny Beth. Now, Jenny Beth, for those of you who have not seen her live, is truly, as I said off the top of the show, one of the best people doing it in all of rock and roll. But that certainly isn't the only thing she does. She is also someone who runs a label, someone who is a very accomplished actor and celebrated actor and definitely kind of moving into that world in a major way as well right now. And yeah, someone who's a true artist. And so someone I've wanted to have on the show for a very long time, and it's finally happened. She has a brand new solo record, which is awesome. It's called To Love Is To Live. You can pick that up now. And yeah, I really, this is a fun conversation. We go to a lot of different places and I learn a lot over the course of this thing. So sit back, relax, and enjoy Jenny Beth on Turned Out a Punk.
I've just did an hour boxing, like literally just stopped 10 minutes ago. I'm really disgusting. I'm very glad this is not filmed.
Yes.
I'm all sweaty and salty and yeah, my hair is all over the place. But you know, it's a bit like how I look when I finish a gig, you know, basically.
Well, I'm glad this is not being recorded because I'm covered in avocado and halloumi because I made lunch for the kids just now. So we're both perfect podcast attire.
Yes, perfect.
Well, Jenny, I want to thank you so much for coming on this show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's a real pleasure.
Well, yes, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Sorry.
No. I was just wanted to say that it's been such a long time we haven't spoken, but I really remember, and I don't know why we didn't meet again, but you know. So when you asked, I was stoked to talk to you again. Of
course. Yeah, it's been like 7 years now. Like last time we did it was for video. So.
Oh my God.
But time flies when we're having fun, and I'm glad we can reconnect now, you know, in our both disheveled attires.
Exactly.
Well, Jenny, there's so much stuff. I'm obviously a huge fan of what you do and what you've done since the last time we spoke, and I want to get to all of it, but I got to start this off the way they all start off, which is, Jenny, how'd you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across the genre?
I would say, it depends what you describe by punk, I suppose, because is, I put a spell on you. Is that punk? You know what I mean?
I kind of feel it is, you know, and it's definitely the foundation of, like, you know, there'd be no Cramps without that.
Exactly. And I think it was, so if we have to go for the feeling of punk music, which is screaming an opinion, then I would go back to Nina Simone, you know, mm-hmm. what I mean? Mm-hmm. In my childhood, singing I Put a Spell on You. But then, I mean, in terms of punk bands, I suppose, and I might be very controversial here, but in terms of what you define as punk music, but you know, when you're a kid, the first music you listen to are the big bands, isn't it? Then mm-hmm. you go niche. I mean, that's how it happened for me anyway, but
absolutely.
So I think the first big bands that were like, had a punk spirit would be The Clash. But again, it might be controversial to say that for some people. But then a little bit later, I would say that my first connection to the spirit of punk and the music of punk would be Fugazi. Mm-hmm. Because when I saw Instrument, I can't remember how old I was, but I listened to the first Fugazi record. Something about it really turned my mind around in terms of how the music and the discipline of living could be all mean one thing. And that's something I had never really felt for music before. I felt it for cinema, mm-hmm. for films, like directors like Cassavetes, where, you know, the work he would produce and the life he would have would be the same. Mm-hmm. You know, art is life and life is art. And I felt that with Fugazi, it was for the first time a band that was not only giving you the best time with their music and the best release of energy, etc., but also it would give you notions of how to live, you know. And I wouldn't go as far as saying education, but actually it was a form of education. I mean, Ian MacKay taught me, you know, some things I didn't know about, you know, about drinking, about being disciplined, about being civil, about respecting others, about, you know, it was a whole philosophy around the band. And I don't know if that's what punk music is, but in a way, you know, yeah, in a way it would be. And by the way, punk music for me, so I grew up in France. I was speaking French and, you know, my family's French. So the English language for me was the language of rebellion, because it was the language of punk music, and it was a language my parents didn't understand.
Yeah. There's a power to that.
Amazing. Yeah, it was. And so I immediately really wanted to learn it.
It's funny you brought up the directors thing, because I've never thought about that, but like, especially with, you know, Cassavetes and directors from the French New Wave, and sort of this idea of like, you know, like your life's work is, you know, expressed through film. But, you know, you always think about film. Well, I always tend to think about film from a Hollywood perspective, where it's like so much of it's make-believe, but there is this sort of whole, you know, real spirit of that sort of directors, you know, bleeding for their art at the same time.
Even in Hollywood movies, I mean, Coppola, for instance, mm-hmm. you know, is one of the examples of, you know, so as you say, bleeding for their art, but without, you know, losing everything, but with really real implications about his personal life and to his work. So,
You mentioned listening to Nina Simone when you were younger. So did you grow up in a house where your parents, like, exposing you to a lot of music? Did they play music at all?
They did play music, although music wasn't the first, the main sort of center of attention. My parents were theater people. Mm-hmm. My father was a theater director and started a drama school as well, like a national drama school in my hometown. And he directed it for years, and he was a drama teacher, and he was my drama teacher actually for several years. So I was trained in the dramatic art, like you say, in France. Yeah. But the music was sort of more in the background. There were a few like French singers my mum would like, you know. But the jazz music came into my life because I was always on the piano, and my parents introduced me to an incredible jazz pianist who became my teacher for 10 years. And I was 8 years old when I met him.
Wow.
And this guy was this genius, older guy. He was a Spanish, from Spanish family. And he was just incredible musician. And he gave me my first opportunities to perform in front of people. And he met me when I was 8. And so he made me sing every Saturday. So I'd go to his house and his wife was there making food. And I would sit at the piano. He would teach me all the jazz standards, you know. And then we would swap seats and then I will sing. And he would teach me, you know, like, I don't know. Your eyes are blue, your kisses too. I never knew what they could do. You know, all the stuff. And Chet Baker and Billie Holiday and Ella Fitzgerald. And then the pianist, you know, he played me all the jazz. He offered me records and books about jazz, the history of jazz, and Mingus and Monk. And it was my first music education. And it was free and happy. You know, it was a really nice time for me, my connection to music then and to singing.
Had you been singing already, or was he sort of the first one to really give you that sort of like instruction?
He was the first one. I mean, I had been playing piano before as a kid on the house piano. I would be constantly playing, improvising things. I couldn't really read music. But I loved it. And so I started learning reading jazz music. So all the chords, you know, the A, B, C and all that. But then he was the first one to teach me to sing. And actually, he used to say that I had a Chet Baker voice, which is hard to believe now. But I think the first time I started to sing, it was very quiet and very calm.
Well, I could hear it just there when you were singing, you know, like that, you know, reminded me exactly of that Chet Baker documentary kind of vocal.
Yeah. Oh, I love that documentary.
Incredible.
So much.
It's so weird that Flea's in it. Like, I think that's probably why I watched it when I was a kid.
Amazing. Yeah, I love that.
So, you know, on the other side of your musical interest, you mentioned getting into The Clash. Where was sort of like the pop music or the popular music entering your life from? Was it radio or was it TV or?
Pop music.
Or just popular music in general, like, you know, everything from The Clash on.
I see. It would be magazines. I would be, you know, I received a magazine every month. I probably begged my parents to subscribe me. There was also like the local record shop I would go to, and I'd try to save money to buy records. Mm-hmm. But I think I couldn't buy more than one a week. And it felt like a really long time to wait. Yeah. And also it was so hard to choose. I could only choose one, and it was hard. They were expensive. Like, yeah. It was expensive to listen to music.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Oh, definitely.
Yeah. But also there was a local venue called Le Confort Moderne, which means modern comfort. Mm-hmm. And it was a venue like they had a fanzine shop.
Awesome.
And yeah, it was really good. And then they had like a whole gallery for contemporary art stuff, like, but more like underground, you know, like new artists, and they had a lot of gigs there. So as soon as I could, I went there to see as many gigs as I could.
What was the first concert you went to, even before you were going to those gigs?
The first concert I went to was with my parents. We were visiting Paris for like 3 days or something, and we walked by a big venue called the Olympia. Mm-hmm. And a French singer, which was one of my mom's favorite, was playing. It's called Bashung. And there were still tickets left. So we took tickets to see him that night. And so we went, and I could see my mom being like so, you know, so in love and so, so crazy about that singer. And he spent the whole gig sitting on a really high chair, you know, and he had leather pants, I remember. And then I remember not really knowing what to think about this. And then I think I was waiting for something to happen, but nothing was happening. And then at the end of the show, I remember walking out of the venue and two older ladies were saying, "Oh my God, he was so rock. How rock was that?" And in my head, I was like, "That was so not rock." Like, you know, I was like, "That's not rock. You think leather pants is rock? Fuck off." So I remember very well that feeling.
Oh, where'd you kind of, you mentioned that other venue you went to. What was the first kind of gig you went to there?
I can't tell you because I can't remember, but I do remember seeing Kim Gordon there.
Oh, awesome. Like solo?
Yeah, she came with a project. Yeah, you know, she always has so many projects. Yeah. I mean, I can't remember who she was working with at the time, but she was playing with a DJ, I think, or with someone. And she was on the guitar and doing vocals. I mean, doing like crazy, amazing things she does.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, and I was quite young then. I was 13 or something. But that was like a legendary sort of venue where Sonic Youth came before and Fugazi came, and you know, in the 90s, 80s. And so there was sort of a history to the place. And there's also this New York band that came to play called Blonde Redhead.
Incredible band. Those. Yeah.
Incredible band. And I used to be a massive fan after I saw them. And I remember their record, buying their record after I saw them, and regretted not having bought the record before I saw them because I didn't know the songs when they played, but they blew my mind. I was completely transcended by that.
So what about local bands? What kind of, you know, local music scene was happening around them? Like, were bands opening for these bands when they would come through?
Yeah, there was a local scene. I mean, in my region, so Midwest of France, 2 hours from the sea, and there's like three major cities there, and we kind of used to fight again who was the coolest, you know, and each city had their venues and but different sort of economies. So sometimes there was a bigger bands to another city, you know. I think my city was more like underground punk, but there was also a lot of DJs coming, DJ Crush, and you know, there was another city nearby where I went to. I used to drive with my sister there for an hour, and I used to see. I remember seeing Interpol for their first show there. So it was more like, you know, trendy bands. Okay, and, you know,
say no more again.
Yeah, and then there was another city called La Rochelle, and that was a really punk city, and there was a bar there where there was always punk bands playing, like local bands. I have actually a really great memory about, I think I was with my parents, I was very young then, and I remember coming back with the car. It was quite late at night, and we were coming back from a trip probably to Italy or something. We were often taking just, they had a van, my parents, and we were just jump in the van and travel. Mm-hmm. And so when we came back, we stopped in this village in right in the middle of France, and there was no one there in that village. And suddenly we hear like the noise, like it's coming from inside a car or something. And then there's this van that pulls up in front of us, and the door, the slide door opens up, and this loud music comes out. And then this guy is dressed as glam rock, you know, yeah. They had like glitter sort of jackets and incredible perms and you know, and boots and colorful. And then I was like, what? And as a kid, it blew my mind. I was like, who is that? And they were obviously a band, and yeah, they were a band from Sweden or Norway or something that were traveling across France. And they opened the door, and the first thing they asked in French, they said, "Where is Fun?" And I was like, wow. Oh my God. I had a little bit of a glam period after that. You know, there was this sort of glam rock, like T-Rex and, you know, even Bowie and this sort of glam thing about music that interested me for a while. So I remember that very well.
So what were some of the local bands called that, you know, you were a fan of then that were, you know, happening and or inspiring?
Oh yeah, that was your question. I'm so sorry.
Oh, no, don't worry. No, absolutely not.
Local bands. So, yeah, there were local bands, and I was one of them at some point as well. I had a band called Motel. God. And they would do like, you know, under bridges sort of festivals, but you know, it was really rough and sort of DIY. But it was fun. There was one band I really love called Microfilm. Mm-hmm. They used to perform in front of like footage of old movies, but it was really like, it was the first time I could see a band I knew that was actually taking care of, you know, their stage performance as well as their music. And it was all instrumental music, and it was really good music. And, but there was a whole concept around it and, around, you know, repatching some scenes from movies and make them work together and recreate a scenario and, you know, and that worked really well. I thought that was really good.
Did they put out any records?
Yeah, they have. Yeah, sure. Locally, for sure.
I gotta check them out.
Yeah.
So what was your motel like?
I don't think it was really, really good. I mean, they were really good musicians. They were big fans of music. And the main guy who formed the band sort of rented a house and bought a van, and we were like, rehearsing in the basement. He would be, you know, there was a mix of people in there, and I think the guitarist was very into melodies, and you know, and I was still very much into jazz in the way I was singing. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't very punk. It was more quite soft. And I never really felt very comfortable with that. but it was a good experience, though. And I actually stopped that band when I met Johnny Hostile. And we started making music together. And I realized, oh, that's what it's like, you know?
Yeah.
I felt it was really a great connection, yeah.
Well, like you mentioned, you know, earlier on, you know, Fugazi being one of those bands that really – you know, turned your head. Were there other bands around that time that you were kind of like, okay, that's what I want to be more like. I don't want to be doing this soft music.
Yes. Well, there was this female band called Electrolane, mm-hmm. Which I was a huge fan of. The D2 records with Steve Albini.
Oh, okay.
Or Free Records. Can't remember.
Oh, Electrolane. I know. Yeah, absolutely. That band's awesome. Okay.
They're amazing. I mean, Mia, the guitarist, is one of the best guitarists I've ever seen on stage. She has this sort of like a bit like Kim Gordon in the sense of, you know, you hold, yeah, it's like tension and then release. And it's really incredible to watch. And I love their record so much. And I love the way it was, you know, they could be really loud sometimes. It wasn't really punk, obviously. Sorry about that.
No.
But that was one of the bands I was a big fan of. And luckily I saw them on their last tour. And there's rumors they're reforming actually right now, but I don't know. That would be awesome.
That would be awesome. Yeah, absolutely. So would you travel a lot to go to other shows in other cities? Was that kind of like, was it, you know, like you mentioned these, you know, the three towns with their different styles. Was it sort of a thing where kids would intermingle from the different places?
Yeah, I would definitely do that. I would rarely go to Paris to see performances, you know. The only time I did that, the first time, and then I started doing it more, but was for Yeah Yeah Yeahs. Mm-hmm. I managed to find a copy, because that was really hard from where I was, all right, of the EP, the first EP they released, before Fever to Tell. And then I was a fan with my friend, and we traveled, took the train and traveled and arrived late to the show, sweating, and then Nick and Brian went on stage, and Karen didn't fucking show up, and it took 20 minutes, I think, for her to show up. I mean, the crowd was going mental, and when she finally showed up, she was rolling herself between the wall and the curtain, so you could see only her feet. And she was sort of screaming in the microphone. I hadn't seen something like that. I was like, what is this? And I was in between, like, I think my mouth was open all the way through, like in shock. But I also wanted to scream, like it was so exciting. So, that was one of my greatest, first experience as a gig on my own with my friend in a city I didn't know. You know, all those things. And they were, So they were, I can't remember how old I was, but I was quite young. And I remember there was Liars as well. I was really a big fan of, and all those New York City bands. And but to go back a little bit, because that's a little bit later, but I think Sonic Youth was one of my big like crush as well, because my drummer in Motel was a huge Sonic Youth fan. So he gave me the biography, he gave me, you know, all their records, and I started to really dig in.
They're one of the best bands ever. Do you have a particular favorite record by them?
Well, actually, you know what? I really love Rather Ripped.
Oh, yeah.
Which is their last record. Yeah. I know it's not very conventional, but I think it's a great record. I think but I mean, Goo was the first one I listened to. Mm-hmm. So I think it was, I bought it because of the artwork. It was so popular, that artwork, right? They had to make t-shirts of those.
Such an iconic cover. Something that just, just Raymond Pettibon's art, like all through Black Flag and stuff. But I don't know, there's just something, like you're saying, about that piece where it just, you know, it hits so hard.
But, you know, like my first hardcore gig was a bit later. It was Johnny Hostile who took me to, I just had a memory. There was a local band. When I started hanging out with Johnny Hostile and making music with him, so I was much more in his city, in Angoulême it's called, and there was an art school there. And the people who gravitated around the art school, which was great, were bands, you know, people in bands and who were connected with those art students, and they were doing parties. One day we went to this gig, and one of the bands was called Grunt, and it was a grindcore band. I had never listened to grindcore ever in my life before. And Johnny Hostile tried to explain the basics of it, and I was so excited about it. What happened? So all the songs were, 10 seconds short, you know?
Yep.
Grindcore style.
Mm-hmm.
And the singer was in a wheelchair, so it was pretty epic. And we were in this sort of deserted place, and on the floor was all this dust. And then in the middle of the gig, when they were still carrying on playing then, one of the guitarists put his guitar down, went into his car. It was redneck style. Went into his car and then started making turns, circles with his car.
Like donuts.
Donuts with his car. And then there was a massive, dust all over everybody. We couldn't even breathe. But with the violence of the music, that was epic. That was beautiful. It was like a piece of art, that moment. And the screaming and that car going, rah! I was like, what? It was really, really epic and great.
I've never heard of a car being used as an instrument until now. That's the first
instance of
that. That's awesome.
Me neither. That was redneck. I loved it. That was a brilliant show. And they were really great guys. I mean, the singer of that grindcore band was a massive Doors fan.
Yeah.
He could play anything on the organ from the Doors, which is, you know, it's a skill.
Absolutely. Doors have some good songs too, you know?
Absolutely. And, you know, Ray Manzarek, he was in The Lazy Guy on the Keys. Like, he was pretty hammering it. So I was really well impressed when we visited him later on in his flat and he was playing us the Doors.
What a diverse taste too for that person to have.
I know. He was a genius, that guy. He still is probably. I haven't seen him for a long time, but I know he still lives there. He's the kind of guy who would know everything about history and, you know, a real geek, like a real nerd in the sense of the word. Yeah, I love that guy very much. He was very clever. He was really into philosophy.
Speaking of, like, you know, history of music stuff, how much awareness is there, you know, growing up, like, about, like, the history of punk in France, like going back to like Stinky Toys and Metal Urbane? Because, you know, like, it starts in at the same time as it's starting, or maybe even before as it's starting in England.
Yeah, because I've heard that Père Ubu was actually a big influence for American bands.
Yeah.
I mean, but you can't really take the crown away from Richard Hell. He keeps saying he's the king of punk, isn't it? So I don't know. I mean, Johnny Rotten, Richard Hell, or is it France? I don't know.
But they were really... Sorry, go on.
No, go for it.
Well, because I guess the Sex Pistols, the first place they ever tour is France, right? They played those shows with the Stinky Toys in like 76 or something.
Yeah. I mean, the Stinky Toys were pretty much there very early on. And also they were touring in England as well themselves. And Ellie Medeiros, the singer of Stinky Toys, she was on the cover at the NME, you know, at the time, which was a pretty big thing. But I think they were amazing. I mean, if you see footages of the Stinky Toys, like TV stuff, it's so amazing. Like, she's talking to the journalist with this really, really nice voice, and she's really quiet. And then as soon as the music starts, she's like, "Wah, yeah!" And she's like bending her knees, and she's on the floor in like 2 seconds. I was like, oh my God.
Oh, they're amazing. I love those records.
Yeah.
So were they played, like, would they be played on, like, you know, radio at all? Or would you, like, see that footage on TV?
No. I saw this footage much later on. I mean, I was too young as well to know them at the time.
Oh, no, yeah. I mean, after the fact type thing.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's internet. I think it's the internet. Yeah. I've got one of my best friends was Etienne Dao, and he's very close to them. He's a really big pop singer in France. Incredible guy who has a real knowledge of, you know, music, and they came from the same city. So in his house, he had all these pictures that of the time and when they were young, and, you know,
That's awesome. I've only really started discovering, like, all these incredible bands from France that I had, like, no idea about, you know, and, like, even like Metal Urbane and like going Metal Boys and this whole history of like proto-industrial or Stinky Toys. Like, that's like proto, what would, you know, eventually people market, you know, or start calling like pop punk or even like Riot Girl stuff before any of that stuff. Like, it's amazing how there's a lot of this sort of, like, you know, the Dentists. I read about this band the other day that never put out a record, and they're going in like 74 in France.
Oh, wow. No, I don't know them.
I had no idea about them until the other day when I was reading this article, but they sound incredible.
I actually think my knowledge in French punk music is quite limited, and you talking to me about it makes me think that I really need to bridge that gap, you know.
Well, it's funny how they don't, like, you know, like American and especially in England, like, you hear about these first wave punk bands, but all these other countries, like even in Canada, we don't hear about all these incredible bands that were coming out back then. It's just kind of like, it's so much is dominated by British or American bands.
It is, and although they did exist, but I think also there's not enough journalists who wrote about them and picked up on them, and, you know, and it's not really media coverage, but you know what I mean, like, history, taking care of that history is a heritage, you know, and that heritage just needs to be, you know, told and cared for, and I think in France, sadly, we take care of our, you know, French singing heritage much more than our English-speaking heritage, which might explain why a lot of English singing bands just ended up being forgotten or not really talked about really well, or because there's generally not much interest if it's not sung in French. Still today, it's a very strange thing, but it's really profound here.
What about music television? Like, I guess there must be, oh, I know there is MTV France, but, like, was there, like, much videos that were being played of bands that were kind of coming up at this time, like the Yeah Yeahs and things like that? Would you see those videos on TV, or is it once again on the internet that you're finding this stuff?
No, I did. There was not much internet then when I was a teenager. My friend had a good connection, and we would go on forums of, you know, bands and try to connect with other fans. And that was the first time I was doing things like that. But it was mainly through press and through TV. And TV there would be like a daily show with a band every night that we all watched. And it was a little bit more mainstream, you know. But I saw you'd see, I don't know, PG Harvey, or you'd see, I don't know, Massive Attack, or so it was more like the late 90s, early 2000s then. And you'd see Jeff Buckley, you'd see Tricky, you'd see I remember discovering a lot of music through that medium, for sure.
It's also amazing, like, all the stuff you're saying, it's all great stuff. You know, it's not necessarily the stuff that you would have been seeing at the same time on, you know, in some of those cases you would be, but not in every case on, like, you know, late night American talk shows or Saturday Night Live or anything like that.
Yeah. Yeah, they're mainly British stuff, what I just mentioned, right? Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of American bands, but nothing comes up.
who were the biggest sort of French bands around that time kind of doing that style? Or like not that, well, you know, like alternative kind of French bands.
Yeah, there was one band called Noir Désir, which I used to listen to when I was a kid. And it was kind of a gun clubby sort of vibe.
Oh, awesome.
And they were massive here. And I used to love them. Sadly, there's been like a big controversial when the singer killed his girlfriend.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Totally. Okay.
So it's pretty controversial to mention them now. And the band is over now, of course, she was a very famous actress here called Mary Trintignant. Mm-hmm. She was a daughter of a very famous French actor here, who I really loved. It was quite tragic. But that was kind of the band I used to listen to around 13, 15.
So I take he's still in prison, I would imagine.
No, he's out now.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Very controversial, but he's out. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Wow. That's definitely, I've never heard of that. It's amazing too, because, you know, obviously Canada has three official languages, but two official languages with Quebec. And with French there. So there's a lot of, I know, cross-cultural, like you find albums, but that's how I know about all these French punk bands, because you would find them when you go to Montreal and go to old record stores. You know, you'd see the Dogs album or all these, like, you know, Stinky Toys 7-inches and stuff like that. But I've never heard of this band at all. And that's such a harrowing story.
Yeah. It's quite sad. I mean, the first record they did, Noir Désir, was very, very a copycat of Gun Club. And then they moved out of it, and then they kind of found their own sound. But the lyrics were really good, and I remember it was a good band. It was a really good band. I'm trying to think of somebody else. We have a French singer right now, which, if you listen to the music, you definitely didn't think it was punk. And actually, you know, when I think it's Fallon, when Fallon does the, he picks a record cover or an artist to make fun of. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's Fallon who does that, right?
I think on Jimmy Fallon he does that, yeah.
Yeah. So he picked him. and then he eventually came to perform on the show. His name is Philippe Catherine.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to describe the level of nihilism in his music. It's to a point where it's almost music for kids. You know what I mean? I don't know how to describe it. It's like like lyrics would be like freedom, my ass, or equality, my ass. Fraternity, my ass, which is the three words of the French nation, you know.
Yeah.
Like, it's real punk. Like, it's real, it's quite gangster the way he does things, but his music is not. But I think it's what we have as close to a punk right now.
So is he mainstream popular, I guess?
Yeah, it's huge. It's huge now. He's even an actor now, and... And but look him up. He looks like It looks like shit. But I used to listen to him when I was younger, and he used to do Bossa Nova.
Oh,
like, wow. He did a whole record with Anna Karina.
Oh.
The actress.
Yeah.
Of Bossa Nova. And yeah, it's fun though.
That is amazing. So like he's at this point, I guess, like, you know, a mainstream star. And is it like sort of French torch music, almost like singer type?
No, it's hard to describe. It's absurd.
Very
it's bizarre. Absurd music. I don't even know how to tell you why. It just, everyone loves it because it's so, there's a whole song where it's him saying, "What is your name? Philip. What is your name? Philip. What is your name? Philip." So he gets really angry. And it's like modern art in
that's
I don't
awesome.
Know.
I Jenny, I got to thank you because you've given me so much to check out. Like, that's why I want to do this podcast.
I'm not sure you'll be so happy once you listen to it.
Oh, there's so much stuff for me to check out now, from microfilm to...
Check his videos. I think if you... I don't know if you have a little bit of French in you. A little bit.
We take it in school.
You might be lost if not.
Yeah. Well, no, they teach it in school, and it's taught so poorly that I know very few people, unless they do French immersion, that wind up with any sense of the French language after they leave school. So, but I do have a bit of a foundation, but I think I will make this work. I will get out my French English dictionary and make this work. So going back to your journey, how did you meet Johnny?
How did I meet Johnny? Through a band of friends we had in common. Like, we had friends in common and they were in a band.
Mm-hmm.
And he was doing like additional keys for them sometimes, and, you know, or production or synths. And the band was like a rock band, and they were my friends. And they eventually got signed, and then got dropped. But I remember they were the first like people I used to hang out that had a band, that had gigs, that had, you know, that were trying to make their own artwork or trying to release a record, you know. And we met through them. I remember at a New Year's Eve party. And the first thing he asked me, I was sort of humming Love Will Tear Us Apart by Joy Division.
Mm-hmm.
And he turned to me and was like, "Do you know Joy Division? Like, do you want to be my wife?" and then I was like, "Yeah, of course, yeah, I do, yeah." And then we started talking. And then we realized we had so much in common, including his ex-girlfriend, who I know had been cheating on him for a year. So I kind of told him that, and we bonded on that. He was like, "She did not." I was like, "Yes, she did." I think it was nice. I mean, after 6 months, we knew each other. I was supposed to go to Leeds for the summer because I always went to England in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
Since I was 15. And I was supposed to go to Leeds to work at a restaurant, you know, and then just spend some time there. And then he said to me, "But, you know, it's nice you're going there, but why don't we just lock ourselves up in a studio and do some music together?" And, you know, it was like, "Fuck Leeds. Let's make some music." I was like, "Yeah, that sounds like a great idea. I mean, I yeah, okay." And then what was great about working with Johnny is that, and up until that point, the only tools I had was a pen and paper. And he taught me how to build the drums. He taught me how to use a microphone. He taught me how to record myself. He taught me how to make edits on the computer. He taught me how compressors worked. He taught me how the desk worked. And... you know, it's, you know, and he kind of said, "Go and do it." You know, he kind of just gave me all those tools. And I was like, "Oh my God, I can do so much." Mm-hmm. Like with all this. And I could be creative with music in a way I had never been doing before. And whenever I'd had an idea, I was like, record it. And there was so much freedom in that. And I'd be so frightened to sing or to scream, or, and then I'd be like kicking him out and just recording my vocals, asking him to come back, you know. Mm-hmm. But it was great because I felt it was a whole new world for me. And also my ideas were appreciated and, you know, and shared. And, you know, it's like any story when you start a band, there's this sort of, ebullition of ideas and excitement. And then we did our first demo with our friend's tattooist who was doing artworks. He did the artwork for the demo. We screen printed them ourselves, you know, and cut them all and did all of that, or, you know, all the copies ourselves. And we shipped them to Rough Trade in London. And they picked it up and they put it on their website and they reviewed it. And we were like, what? I mean, I made this with my hands in glue and, you know, and this was so insane. I can't tell you how excited we were. So we did a MySpace page. And then a few weeks later, there was a promoter in Malta, of all places. So Malta is an island in the Mediterranean Sea, mm-hmm. near Italy. And he calls us because he saw our review on the Rough Trade website. And he thought we were really big. So he said, I'm buying you records. I'm buying you tickets to fly to Malta for this show. And it was our first show. We're like, what? And we were like, yeah, sure. What the fuck? So we said yes. And plane tickets bought. We arrived. We had like really nice welcome room, great people showed us around. We were there for a few days. We had a great time. They had a band as well. We were like listening to, I remember they were big fans of Belle and Sebastian. They were playing us new music I'd never heard. And then came the gig. My God, it was like a queue around the block for the gig. I was like, oh my God, all these people. I mean, at the time it was probably 300 people, 400 people. But for me, it was like enormous.
For a first show, that's incredible. To this day, I'd be stoked if 300 people showed up.
I know. And, you know, and also, yeah, exactly. We were so unprofessional, right, that we set up our gear. Then, you know, the crowd came. I was so nervous. I kept going to the toilet. And then suddenly I couldn't wait anymore. And I looked to Johnny. I was like, we have to go and play. I can't wait. Like, I've got too much fear and we need to go and play. So we go on stage and we start playing. The sound engineer, we forgot to tell him we were going to perform. So he was in the loo. And he was like, is that the band playing? And so he rushed out and, you know, and all the front of house was not open. So nobody could hear what we were doing or barely hear. And then we played for 20 minutes.
That's amazing.
We stepped out of stage and the promoter was like, why are you not playing like an hour and a half? And we were like, that's all we got. We don't have more music. You know, we only released an EP. But they were still very lovely. And that was a really good experience.
So you put out a Motels recording the same year that the Jenny and John, the John and Jen EP comes out. Did they overlap at all the bands? Because you mentioned earlier, did you quit the Motels immediately kind of thing and then just roll right into the new band?
Yeah, I quit my other band immediately. I told the guys that really, you know, I loved them, but I felt that I had found something different there and I wanted to pursue that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It also, I guess, speaks to how influential Rough Trade, you know, still is obviously as a label, but like, you know, it's just such that force ever since it started.
Yeah. And it was a dream. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I really didn't expect them to pick it up. Mm-hmm. But that you know, that's so much, you know, that speaks a lot. That speaks volume about the value of those guys who, like, music lovers working that. Maybe it was an intern, you know, was like, I don't know, bored. But I think generally they love the music.
Yeah.
You know, and they love the effort and we probably wrote a massive letter. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. we made it really look good. And I think it's this sort of DIY thing, and they there was still someone on the other end who could, you know, catch that and notice it. And it was not much for them. But and then when we went to London, because then we moved to London permanently a year after that, we used to go to Rough Trade to just see our demo there. It was still there. Yeah. I mean, they probably didn't sell any, but it was still there.
But they, you know, but it's, you're right. Like it does, you know, no matter how big it got, you know, in with the Smiths and all these bands that blew up on that label, like it still retained that sense of DIY. Like, you know, Sean Forbes works there. Like there's just like a real sort of like sense of it. And they're still like, you know, helping out bands by putting demos in their shop when they don't have to.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That was over 10 years ago. I don't know if they do still do that. I hope they do.
Yeah, I hope they do too. Now that I've bragged about them doing it, I really hope they still do it and they haven't changed.
Yes. This is a reminder, Rough Trade. So, started my whole career.
Yeah. And there's bands from here too. Like I remember there's this band, Barcelona Pavilion, that I don't think played to any more than like 50 people when they were around. But yet here they were featured in Rough Trade. And because of that, they got to do a Peel session. They got, you know, all these things out of that. And it was just because of this cool DIY thing.
Exactly.
You mentioned moving to London. Where did like, was that kind of immediately after the Malta gig?
It was probably a year after.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what kind of scene did you fall into playing? Like, did you play much live when you got back to France with the band?
We played a few gigs, you know, in our hometown and then maybe one or two in Paris, but it was clear that France was not going to be the country. We were singing in English. And also it was always had been a dream of mine to move to London. Cause, as I said, like from the age of 15, I went there every year, all the time, anytime I could. And I knew, a few people there. And so I suggested to Johnny to first, we went there ourselves. We drove there. So from our city, so it was like 12 hours drive. And, we take the boat to cross the sea. Mm-hmm. And then he liked it and he liked the people I introduced him to there. And then we permanently moved there in 2006, I think, October 2006. And the first thing we did was just to give our MySpace address to every promoter in every club in every bars of the city. We'd go to, you know, per what we had been reading about, you know, Joy Division, or we'd go to the Hope and Anchor, you know, the first club Joy Division played when they first came to London. And mm-hmm. It was the night that Ian Curtis had his epileptic fists, you know, his first. Anyway, it was, but when we played there, it was a shithole. It was... It smelled like piss and alcohol and I was sick and there was no one there. So it was, you know, so you start to understand how the city works. We had like bad promoters who made us pay to perform. And then we were like, okay, that's not what we need to do. So you sort of learn, you know, and we were living in this bedroom in this house with other people. And this room became our rehearsal place, our recording place. We did our entire first record there. And where we would eat and, you know, watch TV and then rehearse and then write. And then whenever we could, we'd perform. And I was I was teaching French, for my income. And then we found this venue in northwest London called the Luminaire, in Kilburn. It's called the area. It doesn't exist anymore, but I have like memorabilia of objects from there because we played the last gig there when it closed down. And that place became our home. We started working there, doing security or the door or cloakroom or. And we became super friends with the sound engineer, and the sound engineer is still my sound engineer now. Mm. And we became really close friends with the director there, the promoter, who became Savage's tour manager later on. And those people welcomed us, and it was the first sort of place where we could perform whenever we wanted. We could, you know, see all the bands we wanted to see. And and also meet, like, it was a really good quality club. It was, the music and the sound system was very, very high quality. It was great. But there was like big signs on the wall saying, shut up. If you're here to talk to your pals, go downstairs. This is a place for music.
I was just about to ask you, because I think I played that show and I was going to say, did they have signs on the wall that shut up when the bands are playing?
There you go. Yeah.
Oh, and it has like a, it had like two or three steps down just before the stage.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, I that was an incredible club. Absolutely.
It was so good. Oh, it was, yeah. And the people there, that when we played the last show there, and the Ingalls, the promoter and director of the venue, he created a whole funeral so, with a coffin. It was how crazy and serious he was about his job. I've never seen someone work so hard in a venue of this size. He cared so much.
Yeah.
And you could see like bands from Australia. You could see bands from America. There was so much you could connect with so many people. And I think the first, I always remember that the first audience I had was other artists in a way. They were the first to give me accolades and say, this is good. What you're doing is good, you know. And it's in places like this that it could happen.
It also seems like when you got to London, you're very much doing, like we were talking about off the top, like the kind of Fugazi, Cassavetes thing of really living with your art.
Yeah. Yeah, because they were my heroes. And you know, the Cramps. Because also I was in a couple, in a relationship with someone I was making music with. So obviously like any sort of couple in music would be my models, you know, Sonic Youth, of course, or even Johnny Cash and Jim Carter, in a different style. I love this sort of, and the Cramps obviously. And, you know, I was romanticizing a lot. That life and that moment in my life. And, you know, I remember telling Johnny, I'm not an artist, you know, I can't call myself an artist. He was like, what the hell are you if you're not an artist? You know, that's what you're doing right now. And I just couldn't really realize that's what I was doing. And sometimes it's a shame because it takes time to catch up with what you're already doing. I've always been doing that, like doing things before I understand what I'm doing. I remember it with really great, with a lot of, it was hard, you know, it was also really hard. I remember, you know, loading gear in the snow, in the heat, in the rain. And, I remember doing small tours, coming back with no money. I remember, you know, but also everything was possible. So I think, when we released our first record and we packed the Luminaire, for instance, I was shaking with fear, but I couldn't believe there were people there. Mm. It's like, really? For us? It's amazing.
It's also, I've had like a lot of, you know, artists on recently that kind of came out of London, and it's amazing how hard of a town that is to be a musician, just because it's so predatory and and the music industry sucks at the best of times, but it seems like it super sucks there, like having to pay for shows and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it got a bit better. I've got really good friends now who are promoters in London and they're doing an incredible job. Mm-hmm. I just think, it was particularly then pretty, you know, venues were pretty derelict. Sorry, no, that's not a word. Is it a word?
Derelict.
Thank you. Derelict. Venues were pretty derelict and they were run down and there was no money. I think now it's a little bit better. If you still play the Windmill in Southeast London, you're still playing a shithole, you know, but it's got a great history.
Yeah.
And people go there for a different experience, you know, and it means something else, you know. But there's so many in the course of 10 years, can't tell you how many clubs shut down. Like, it's insane. So many places have parts of my history and the history of those times is gone. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, CBGB's gone. You know what I mean? but those clubs, I mean, CBGB's uber legendary, of course. But I think those clubs have a part of history to tell, you know. And when they shut down, it breaks my heart.
Yeah, because you're right. Like, it's also the shutting down of like a little ecosystem that forms around these clubs, like you yourselves in the Luminaire.
Yeah, it's an ecosystem, exactly. And you need that when you're a musician, because you need to, when you start from nowhere with no contacts, no connection, you need those people at, you know, at the grassroots of music, and that's where you start. And I'll never forget, you know, the way I was treated, the way, the respect. When we performed the first time we performed at the Luminaire, the sound engineer, Matt Farrar, who became our sound engineer from that day, said to us, are you got any shows in London after this one? And we said, yeah, we've got another one next week at the Social. He was like, I'll be there. And we thought, oh, he's just going to be there to see the show. No, he came to do the sound.
Wow.
For free. You know, for free.
Yeah,
and he did
yeah.
that for 2 years for us for free. And then when we finally got a record deal, we gave him a bunch of money, you know, to pay him back for all what he had done for us.
Mm-hmm.
And then we made him stay with us until now.
It feels like that also would have been such an exciting time. Well, I was like, that was the first time we went over to play around London, around that sort of like 2006, 2007 era.
Yeah.
And it feels like you're saying it's better now, because that was sort of like almost like a new wave of kids showing up in bands and clubs and venues. Like, it felt like, you know, like there was sort of like bubbling up of what would become the new scene in a couple more years.
Yeah, I mean, definitely when I started Savages, just before I started Savages, so that's like 5 years forward, and we end Jan and Jen. We don't want to do another record of Jan and Jen. We start our own record label called Pop Noir. We've had really bad experiences with contracts we signed with record companies. It's the first contract you sign, and obviously you sign for life, forever, everything. And for a check that seems really big at the time, because you've kind of lived with nothing all that time, but in retrospect, it's nothing, you know. But anyway, and I do remember that I felt a bit frustrated with the scene in London. It felt that at that point, it was all about the bands and their management and playing shows just for the sake of being seen by agents. It was like showcases after showcases, and the crowds were not engaging, or they were not invited to be engaged, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember very well that when I started Savages, I thought, I want to change that. Like, I don't, and so that's why very early on we put all those signs about not using your phones during gigs, trying to capture people's attention. And that was kind of an influence of the Luminaire as well, you know, putting signs up. That's something I learned from Andy Ingalls, who was still our tour manager then.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, the only band that really was creating chaos wherever they played was this Japanese band called Boningen.
Boningen.
And Boningen. And Boningen they still exist. They're still a band. And they're incredible musicians. And every time they played, it would be like a storm washing you over. It would be like sort of uplifting but crazy. You never knew if a guitar was going to swing up you know, just above your head. You would never know. It's so explosive, and with very long straight hair, they looked incredible. So I was a massive fan of Boningen, and so when we started Savages, my whole intention was about the stage, was about live performance, was about trying to revive. I was sick of people telling me about punk music and how it was great before, how it was great in the 80s, you know, and how, well, now, you know, it's in the past. Fuck those, you know, BBC documentaries again and again about, you know, sort of washing us about how it used to be amazing. But I was like, but what about now? You know, we have things we want to say, you know, things that really make me angry, and I really want to shut them, scream them. And then I felt the crowds were still not engaging, so it was about trying to find a way to make that happen.
And like, so yeah, what, as far as artists that were engaging, because like, you know, obviously Kim Gordon's an incredible performer, but she's not attacking that stage in the same way that you attack that stage in her style. Like, were there any influences specifically that were like, that you were driving towards as far as like that kind of owning the stage?
Yeah. Yeah. Susie, you know, of course. I mean, I was compared to her a lot when I started, and I always was like, no. You know, it's this idea of like, I have no masters. But obviously Susie, I mean, she's, I remember watching footages of her. I'm trying to understand how she would stand, you know, how she, my big question about stage performance was, what do I do when I don't sing? Because I think when I'm singing, I'm all right. I think I know what I can do. What do I do when I don't sing?
Yeah. I feel the same. I feel that so much.
But you need to take care of those gaps, because that's what's going to make the whole gig a whole difference. If your intensity goes down every time you're not singing, you're losing everyone.
Yeah.
You know, between each line. Mm-hmm. So that was one of my first questions. I think it was a mix of my French influences from my roots, like Jacques Brel. I used to watch a lot of his performances because I love what he used to do with his hands. And the drama, the French drama, I think is really, really rooted in me. Which obviously, you know, the punk bands were really influenced by French culture, you know, by Baudelaire, by, you know, and poets and writers of, you know, the French romantics. And so I felt that I had some of that in me that I could use. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was Patti Smith. She's the sort of mother figure, obviously. There was PG Harvey. There was great performances, you know. But there's also Iggy Pop. Mm-hmm. Iggy, I saw him on one of the first Savages tours. We toured in Europe and played the same festival as the Stooges. I mean, you know, I think he fell on me 100 times during that show. And I mean... Yeah, it was quite amazing to be able to see them and not feeling like you're being robbed of your history, you know, like it's here and now still.
Exactly. Yeah. Like the only band I've ever seen where it feels like this would be the same in 68 as it is now with his performance. It is.
Oh, completely. Completely. Yeah. My other role model was Henry Rollins in so many ways. I mean, and then I stole some stage moves from Mac Patton. I have to admit. I mean, you know, the spreaded legs and two hands on the mic, screaming down, looking at the floor. Yeah, that's Mac Patton. I even stole his haircut, you know what I mean? But I mean, he's okay with that. He loves it. Come on.
I stole Iggy's flip your wig thing where he puts his hand on his head and lifts it up like his head's flying up. I take that every show.
So. Oh, I love that. I stole from Iggy his way of walking when his hips are going really exaggerated, sort of doing circles on each side.
Yeah, you know, yeah, like, yeah.
Very feminine, very. Or the gorilla, like the whole limbs shaking.
It's also funny you brought the theater influence and performance influence, because when you see, you know, interviews with John Lydon, he talks about how it wasn't musicians that were influencing him. No. It was like Richard Burton performances and things like that.
Yes. Yes. The mimes and, you know, and yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I remember because I saw a documentary back then about Johnny Rotten, you know, always opening wide his eyes on pictures. And I thought of doing something different. So I was frowning a lot. In fact, if he's opening, I need a signature look when I'm being photographed. So I used to be frowning a lot. People hated that.
Yeah.
They hated me frowning. Like I haven't met one photographer saying to me, can we do a picture where you're not frowning and you're smiling? And I was like, no.
What a weird thing for them to request. It's like, no, you're here to document me.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I'm an animal. You're documenting me. Yeah, exactly.
Jenny, this has been amazing. Would you come back at some point for a part two?
Oh, yes, I would. Absolutely. God, am I invited for part two?
Oh, absolutely. This has been lot of fun. Oh, my gosh. But before I let you go, can I just I just want to talk to you about that moment where flying to Berlin and Husbands, that single kind of just like blew up. Like it seemed like it caught, you know, and obviously, you know, your projects earlier had buzz around them. But like this felt like from the outside, something different. Like, I just wondered what it was like for yourself, like during that time.
So the single came out on my label, Pop Noir Records. How long you got? Because I don't know if I'm going to do a short one or a long one.
I've got time. I just don't want to keep you all day.
Yeah. So many aspects I could talk about. First, to release it on my record label was a real battle, like with the band. I really struggled to make everyone okay with that idea of doing something DIY, doing something, you know, starting from doing it ourselves. I think I had the structure. I just wanted to go with it and do it. But I felt there was a lot of resistance with management at the time, and it was already a fight in that idea. But I succeeded in making it happen. And you have to imagine, like, when we put the pre-order on, we got immediately 500 requests. I was the one doing the shipping, okay? I mean, it's a label I created like 6 months before. We don't have staff. Like, it's not like, I don't. And I'm like, shit, how do I send 500 records? I mean, that's a lot. And so I asked the band, like, guys, I need help. Like, you need to come to my house. And I bought all these envelopes and everything. And I was like, we need to get cracking. Like, and we had in the end this sort of, with a friend of mine, I remember going to the post office in my van. We had like probably 10 massive bags. And then I sort of arrived, and the post office officer was like, no, you're not bringing this in. I was like, it has to go. The fans are waiting. You know, it was like so important. And then they made me put everything back in my van, and I had to do everything from home and then bring back the bags already with the timber post on it, on them. I mean, it was a whole, it took me days. It was a real mayhem, but you know what? I'm so glad I did this, you know? I'm so glad I did this. And recently, actually, I thought about this moment again, because during confinement, I received a massive amount of boxes in my home to sign my records for the pre-orders of To Love Is To Live.
Yeah.
So I did that. I was fine with doing it. Then I reboxed them and they were ready to ship. And then I had to find a way, because I was working in the studio all day when they were supposed to be picked up. So I asked my neighbor, can I put them in your, you know, place? Can they come? So I was carrying all the boxes with my bare hand through the street going to his place. And I was like, this is like old times. You know, I've done this before. And I think somehow the reason why it was okay for me, I mean, this all happened because of confinement, and I was never supposed to receive those boxes at home. And, you know, the label was supposed to take care of them, but we had to because I couldn't travel to London.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I thought, you know what? I'm resilient because I can do this. I've done this before. And it's no problem for me. Maybe a lot of people, maybe some people would have felt a bit overwhelmed by this, or like, how do I even do this? But I think I was pretty, I just tapped myself on the back thinking, you can do this and you've done this before, you know. Going back to the basics, you know.
Jenny, anytime you want to come back and go back to the basics and talk about the basics, this podcast door is always open for you.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a real fun to talk to you. I'm going to have a shower now and get a bit of food.
I got to go make dinner now.
Oh, well, maybe there's some left on your shirt you can use, you know.
Hey,
Thank you, Jenny, for coming on the show. And you heard right there, Jenny will be back for a part two at some point in the future, because there's a lot more to talk about. There's definitely a lot more to get to. And yeah, and check out her new record. It's, as I said, phenomenal streaming, and it's out there in the world. Physical copies are out there in the world too. To Love Is To Live. Speaking of loving and living, next week on the show, we are going to be doing some loving and living. I guess it's kind of later on this week and into next week on the show, because we are going to be doing a Punk Is Metal two-shot with two of the greatest vocalists in metal, but also two of the most down punk rock hardcore kids I've ever spoken to. Well, adults, you know, they're adults, but you know, hardcore kids in the descriptor sense. We have next week on the show, first from the band Sepultura, from the band Outface, just the legend. This is an amazing episode. Oh my gosh. Derek Green is on the show. Derek, of course, has been the singer of Sepultura for well over 20 years at this point. But before that was in a bunch of bands. We get into all that. But also in Outface, a legendary, obscure band that connects Integrity, Sepultura, Civ, and Filter. And we talk about all of it. It is a monster episode. And then after that, a couple days later, I'm going to be dropping an episode with the great Barney Greenway of the band Napalm Death. It just hit me that both of them have that last name with Green in it. That just hit me all at once. I'm sorry, I've never noticed that before. I don't know how I didn't notice that till right now as I'm looking at my notes, but wow, that's a weird coincidence. But anyway, that has nothing to do with why they were booked together. They are booked together because they are legendary vocalists and also people that, oh my gosh, both these conversations go really cool places and I think really situate, you know, the punk influence on a lot of metal music and the hardcore influence on a lot of metal music. And, you know, we get into it. It's fun. Oh, I'm excited for these two. Oh, I can't wait for you to hear them. Also, Derek would not be on the show without the help of my buddy, the introduction of my buddy Danko Jones. Danko, you know, being friends with Derek and being my friend, made it all possible. So, you know, as always, I should be plugging his podcast too, because he plugs this podcast on his show, and I would not be doing this podcast without his podcast. That's where I cut my teeth, as I've mentioned before on this thing. So check out the Danko Jones podcast. It is amazing, especially if you like, you know, like if you're punk rock, if you're into punk rock music, but you also like rock and metal, this is the perfect bridge. He covers a lot of other stuff too. It's a fascinating podcast and a labor of love by one of the coolest people I know. So thanks, buddy, for setting this up with Derek too. I really appreciate it. And that's it for me, everyone. Thank you for listening once again. Remember, Black Lives Matter, the lives of Indigenous people matter. Go out there and get informed, get involved, sign petitions, show up if you can, donate money if you can, vote, you know, plug your nose and vote, because, I'm one of those people that feels like it's just, you know, trying to push that button to prevent the end of the world. So go out there and try and affect change if you can. And, we're in this together. We're fighting this shit together. Fuck fascism. And, that's it. You know, go out there and make your own culture too. It helps. And you know, it might help other people too. So go out there and do that if you can. Sign your organ donor cards, because by the time they come for those organs, you're not going to need them. And it can help, you know, donate blood if you can. Do these things if you can, you know, try as best you can. And I love you. And I'll see you later on this week with two dream episodes for me. Man, I love doing this thing. Thank you, Tristan, for all the hard work you do. Thank you to the Patreon people. Thank you to Vans. Bye-bye.